A travel journal used to taking its readers on unforgettable journeys continues to make strides of its own. A more recent addition to the cellar of indie publishing that's bringing a welcome fresh perspective to its subject matter of wine. And here, boy! The Canine Focus magazine that always has a new trick. Wine and walkies ahead today on the stack. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack. 30 minutes of print industry analysis with me, Tom Edwards. I don't know about man's best friend, but some of The Stack's pals from Dog Magazine are here later, and we'll be raising a glass to Above Sea Level Magazine too. But we start with another familiar voice to this programme, Liz Schaefer, editor of Lodestar's anthology. Liz, warm welcome back to The Stack. A long-standing friend of the programme, and always good to check in with you and your very capable team with all your excellent doings that there are. Let's talk a bit about England, the sort of the reimagined England anthology, because this is kind of interesting, isn't it? In so many ways, it's sort of going back to go forwards. I don't mean that pejoratively at all. Tell us a bit about, well, remind listeners, in case they're not familiar with the sort of latest edition, what that was and how you and your team sort of arrived at that decision.
Well, basically, back in September 2014, we released the first magazine, and that was England. And that was released on, I'm going to say, adrenaline and sort of this creative fear that somebody else was going to take this idea I had for a magazine. So we had to, from coming up with the idea for Lodestars to releasing that first England magazine, we had 8 months. We just had to get it out before we lost that drive or somebody else, you know, did it better than we did.
Stole your thunder to a degree, yeah. And it's interesting, I suppose, so many of the people we speak to on this programme talk about that mad, adrenaline-fueled, always a rush, whatever time generous time frame you've allowed yourself, there's always a rush. Even going back to that time, we've probably talked about this before on the programme, did you feel there were things that did get timed out? You were too rushed almost, I mean, I guess you almost always are. Were you sort of planning the how I might have done things differently, even as it was happening first time around?
It was very much for me a case of learning on the job. I had done the behind the scenes work before. I'd been a freelance writer and photographer, but I'd never done the work involved in creating a magazine in the sort of the business side of it and finding professional relationships with, you know, not only creators, but people who can help you actually make a physical thing. So for me, it was sort of very much learning on the job. And at the time, you don't feel like you're skipping anything. You feel like you're giving it your all. But looking back, you're like, oh God, there's a lot of things I would have done very, very differently, which is why we did want to do it again. We now have this massive international team of utter brilliance. We have 4.5 years of experience. We could make a very different product. And that's what we wanted to do. And also, Lodestars was always designed to be collected. I mean, even in the cover design with the spines all having a different image, they're meant to look good on a shelf. So many people didn't know about us until later issues, and England was completely gone because, again, I didn't quite get it right figuring out quantities. So it was a chance for people to have that full collection and to sort of, for us to see from that first issue to this new reimagined issue, what we'd come and how we'd changed. Because in the process, sometimes looking, you know, on the inside, you can't tell.
And it is interesting, you talk there about the sort of collectability, and this is something obviously that I think Monocle subscribers and readers will have with the familiar sort of black spines. You're again, a very sort of signature look. And it's interesting, if people go on your website, for example, you can see the issues, they're scarce. They're hard things to come by. That must give you so much pleasure, I guess, all the team, this idea that you've really delivered on that. There is a scarcity, which is obviously always good from a marketing point of view, but it's also, it speaks to the way that your readers perceive what it is you're doing, if you see what I mean.
No, I do. It's also for us the nature of travel and the sort of the traditional nature of magazines. They were available for a very short period of time and then they were gone. They were of a moment, and what we create is very much of a moment because everything is done from experience. It's how you feel in that particular time, in that particular place. And it's almost good that they sell out because that country or how you feel in that country would be very different 3 years later. So that product is no longer as pure as it was, for lack of a better word.
Yeah, well, and I think England, I mean, in particular, obviously we don't need to get into the...
No.
A few, one or two background instances that are sort of rolling on at the moment. Let's not get into
it. It was an interesting time to be doing it.
That is really interesting. I wonder, did you, even with the enthusiasm to go back again and look and bring different perspectives and different skill sets to it, did you sort of learn more about the subject matter through the sort of reimagined edition in a way?
Again, it was just a sense of going back. When I first moved here from Australia, I was just obsessed with English travel. I wanted to see as much of this country as I could because it is such a novelty when it's not your own. And then because Lodestars has been so busy and so constant, I haven't had the chance to really explore my own back garden. So it was lovely to go back and see and just to be reminded how bonkersly brilliant this country is. It is so diverse. It is so wonderful. And it's full of really beautiful, creative, passionate people doing amazing things with the land, with food, with art, with hospitality. And I do think a little bit in the current climate, which is largely depressing and scary, we do forget what is there. And it was just a chance to remind ourselves and hopefully remind our readers that know that there is beauty and there is wonderful things and you can find them in the world.
And I guess that feeling of being fortunate extends to being able to kind of spin the globe and see where you're headed next. And I always like to get a sense of what the year holds in store for Lodestars. And there are some very exciting destinations ahead, essentially. Portugal in the springtime, what's not to enjoy? Tell us a bit about, again, I know I've asked you before, how do you boil it down? Obviously, you don't want to go to the sort of region that you've just been in and, you know, you want to keep people guessing and keep surprising them. But how on earth do you finally boil it down and start to? Because you're planning 2-3 sort of locations ahead almost.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like at the time that we make these decisions, it's very clear and very obvious and it makes utter sense. And then you look back a couple of months down the track, I don't know why we did this. I think for us, after doing India, which was such a big, exciting, sort of unexpected magazine to make, it was almost needing to come back to Europe, to come back somewhere that was familiar, where most of our contributors were based, and essentially have what I thought at the time was going to be an easier project. It never is, but it just seemed closer to home it would be. But it's also, you know, having a bit of variety. Portugal is such a unique, different country, and I hadn't been there a huge amount before making the magazine, but I'd always loved it, and I've always loved how it manages to blend sort of history and quirk and creativity with this sense of melancholy, for lack of a better word. I thought that was so romantic and wonderful. And then we wanted to do Switzerland because it was exciting to tell the story of a country that I don't think many people would look to as a holiday destination, whereas it's this beautiful wonderland. And then we will be doing Mexico, which will be coming out in 2020, and that's because we wanted something big and exciting and on sort of, you know, a day-to-day level, a bit scary to make because it's the other side of the world and the logistics come into play. So it's various factors guide your decision-making. They're difficult to remember down the track, though.
And I guess it's really important that you and your team are also on a bit of a journey of discovery. Not sound talking too many cliches and platitudes, but I really feel like the readers get a sense of that shared journey, that bit of discovery, and you need to keep things fresh and discover those things as you go. Otherwise, I think you can risk box ticking, presumably. We started off by talking about revisiting and going right back to 2014, is that correct? Yeah, seems a long time now. How has that longevity really, and that perspective, but also the utility of the experience, how's that changed sort of how you work with contributors? Do you find now that people know, sort of understand the Lodestar shorthand in a way that's helpful for you, in a way that perhaps they didn't in the first couple of iterations, or is that not really an issue?
It's multi-layered. I think the first four issues, until we came out with Italy, which is issue four, we were still figuring out our voice, our balance. There was, you know, a time that we played with poetry, we played with longer form writing, and it's sort of around Italy, which was 2.5 years ago now, we figured out how we were doing it. I do think what's lovely about the contributors who reach out to us now, who are only coming on board in sort of issue 11, issue 12, is that they've read Lodestars before and they like it, and what we do resonates, and that is... It's so wonderful to hear, because you make this project with sort of grand dreams and goals, and to hear that people respond to that is wonderful. But at the same time, we've also had contributors who have been with us since those early issues, and having those relationships is wonderful, because I think anybody in indie magazines will tell you it can be a lonely world to be in. At the end of the day, it does tend to be one or two people alone in a room overthinking everything they've done in their lives. So to have people who are equally madly creative and understand the project and have their own creative worlds going on, and to be able to have those relationships, you know, professionally and as friends, really does keep you sane.
And what is about the newsstand rivals? Again, it's kind of a question I often ask of editors, and there's the creative forces behind magazines, particularly those that have had success over a more sustained period of time. Is it busman's holiday when you're browsing the newsstand, especially if you look at travel titles, especially if you see titles that, I don't know, have borrowed a leaf or two of paper from Lotus, can I say? What's that experience like? I mean, I guess it's the highest form of flattery, a little imitation, so that must be good. But can you sort of separate your enthusiasm for great magazines and great writing, travel reporting and all the rest, from your sort of more business hat? Are you able to look and not consider things rivals? How does that work when you're looking at the news?
I'm a shocking businesswoman. It's terrible. I mean, the thing about independent magazines and travel indies in particular is that we're all facing the same obstacles. It's hard for all of us. It doesn't, in the last sort of 4.5 years that we've been out, it's been lovely to see that the magazines coming out are staying out, which wasn't the narrative when we started. So you go to the newsstand and you see these titles, and it's lovely because you've had coffee with those editors. You've had chats on Instagram. You do magazine swaps because we know that our readers approach the newsstand and respect what we're making. And if they're going to buy one magazine, not naming names, they're probably going to buy the other one as well because they love what we're doing. And we all, you know, even if we borrow bits and bobs from each other, we all are doing a very different thing. So I don't think for me that competition is there. There is this sense, again, of I'm not alone. Other people are doing this, they have helped me, and I will help them any way I can.
Very collegiate, the independent publishing sector, which is good to hear. Just to touch briefly on that, you alluded to it there, mentioned it really explicitly in terms of the challenging landscape. It's the start of the year. How do you sort of feel about where things are headed in 2019? We talked about the issues confronting Britain broadly, not just publishing, but all business and all the rest. Is it the same old chestnuts about monetizing, looking at challenges in terms of distribution? How do you build on growth? How do you make it sustainable? How do you build other partnerships in other markets? This kind of thing. Is it still those narratives? I mean, is there anything particular that worries you or that you're maybe more optimistic about as we look at the next 12 months?
I think the biggest worry, again, remembering that we are small teams, is always being concerned that you're not doing enough. And that is a really tough thing to, a tough thought to stop having because it does sort of dampen the creative process. But I mean, for a lot of us, it is about the organic growth. It is about creating a product that is beautiful, that is positive, because that's something people need. And hopefully that is enough to carry us forward. I mean, distribution networks are changing a lot. And I think people are now understanding how indies work and how indies are being bought. And there are distributors in the UK like MMS who just really, really understand it and really get you into the right places. And I mean, we've tried different models. For me, it's lovely to actually have a relationship with our stockists as well, because they know what is selling, what is working, where it needs to be, what needs to change. So it's about not beating yourself up too much, making something beautiful and hoping for the best.
Well, I don't think I can follow that. Liz, great advice, as always. If there's aspiring independent publishers out there, I think they'd do very well to follow your words of wisdom. Great to hear from you, as always. And we'll hopefully see you, I don't know, Portugal in spring, Switzerland in the summer, somewhere around there.
Maybe something exciting around December. We'll see.
Oh, there's a cliffhanger for our audience. Liz, great to see you. Thanks for coming to see us. Above Sea Level is a beautiful journal edited by Amy Hartley that has as its founding mission starting a different conversation around wine. Amy, from whom you might have heard, or more accurately read, in the pages of Monocle magazine, joined me a little earlier to tell me more about it.
I think traditionally wine journalism has been quite myopic. It's focused very much on elaborate flavour descriptors and details about soil and rocks and things that people find quite difficult to engage with unless you already have a certain amount of kind of vinous knowledge up your sleeve. For me, wine is very much about people and place and the relationship between the two. And I felt that wine journalism could really do with a bit of a refresh, you know, not taking away from any of the authenticity of wine itself, but just offering a fresh perspective, which is hopefully what I've managed to do with Above Sea Level.
Well, and I think I've myself fallen into the trap of thinking there was a traditional way of writing about wine or talking about wine or considering wine journalism. But I gather you think that even the things that we think are the traditional approaches are themselves not that old. It's a storied history, but actually it's relatively recently written. Do you think one of the key risks, whether it's about wine or wine journalism, is that people just make assumptions that aren't borne out by fact? Is that a problem? Is it a whole sector, a theme that for whatever reason draws people into jumping to inaccurate conclusions about things?
I think this idea of kind of accuracy versus inaccuracy is really interesting in itself, because taste is so subjective. My role as a wine journalist, I see, is not to tell people what I think they should like. It's to inspire them to drink better and to experiment. And I think experimenting is something that people traditionally find quite difficult with wine because they feel like they need to know about it before they can really get into it. And I think traditional wine journalism is interesting in itself because really flavour descriptors and point system, which Wine Spectator and Decanter brought around, and Robert Parker, who's been a very big wine critic, they really only have happened since the 60s and 70s. So the way that we've kind of talked about wine for this period of time is really quite limited. Before that, we can look back to literature, we can look back to poetry and people waxing lyrical about the amazing aspects of wine and using metaphors and it being quite decadent, and then even reaching back to ancient Greece, Socrates used to prescribe different styles of wine for different ailments. I think it's really fascinating to see actually that wine journalism now is almost more limiting than it's ever been. Mm. I do think in the last few years that has been changing with publications like Noble Rot and Alchemy and Pipette, and I think that people are more receptive to hearing about wine, and people are playing around a little bit more with how that's done.
And tell me a bit about the approach, because I think leafing through certainly these two volumes we have here, obviously there's pages where there are some bottles of wine, glasses of wine. But for a lot, you know, there's a lot of just beautiful photography. It's obviously a beautifully designed piece. You know, at a quick browse through, you could be forgiven for not even being able to immediately divine that it is a wine magazine. How committed were you to bringing, because I mean, I sense you must have a great love for independent publishing and for some of those sort of principles that maybe define some of your own favourite magazines.
I do.
Of balancing a passion for wine with a passion for print as well. Is it a question of marrying those two up? Are they natural bedfellows?
I definitely think they are. And wine is such a tactile thing. For me, it's an experience. You know, when I meet winemakers, I try and have dinner with them. I sit with them. I ask some questions. I learn something more than is just about the wine that they're making. And that's what makes it really interesting. But Above Sea Level also looks at wine in context of food and design and people and place. And really, I think that's what I'm personally interested in. And I really hope kind of resonates with readers, because working with people like Stack magazine on this issue was really exciting for me, because the magazine went out to 3,800 people that might not ever pick up a wine magazine. And I very specifically have chosen to talk about wine in the context of other things and use it more as a thread than a kind of focus. And I think and hope that means that wine kind of resonates with more people as a result.
But I wonder, what about the pressure that you put on yourself? I mean, do you have a sort of a selection of cuttings or maps of places you want to go that is growing exponentially? Because, you know, I guess you could probably reel off 50 practically editions of the magazine that you'd like to start commissioning and reporting yourself tomorrow. What's that process like? I mean, obviously it is fun, but it's kind of restrictive in some ways. Or do you just think, look, it's the whole globe to potentially look at, so one step at a time?
Yeah, it's interesting because I'm changing every single time I make an issue. So my learnings from each issue are so valuable in terms of, you know, why I even started to do this in the first place. And I think when I choose an issue or a country or a region, it's because I feel like there's this really lovely balance between relevance for that moment, that the timing is right, but also the sense of timelessness. So for me, California was my first issue. I lived in San Francisco for 2 years, 10 years ago, and it's a bit of a love letter to California because it was where my love of wine began. And it's, you know, as a place, it's very forward-thinking, it's very experimental, and it really shaped the way that I think about wine today. And then Portugal was interesting for me and very different because I hadn't spent much time there. But I knew that Portugal was becoming creatively very interesting. And I thought that there must be a different story to tell about the wines that weren't just rooted in their fortifieds, which were Port and Madeira. I spent a long time going kind of back and forth in Portugal and trying to find these people and find out why they were making this kind of fresher style of wine and how they were working with really, really old vineyards and going back to kind of pre-industrialization, you know, and the way that they're working the fields and working very gently with their wines is something that is really interesting to me. And the Portuguese are very quiet, very humble people. You know, you can go to America and somebody can chat forever about what makes them excited. You have to spend time with the Portuguese to understand them and for them to trust you and for them to share things with you. And it really forced me to slow down and take my time. I didn't really have another choice in how to make this issue. I find that really valuable in itself, and you know, really supporting those winemakers and photographers and writers and talent. You know, that is one of the most exciting things for me, is how can I kind of push those people out there into the spotlight, so they get a bit more kind of, you know, celebration for what they're doing.
I mean, let's just talk a little bit about the future a little bit. And I wondered, from you talked about the learnings from each issue and this sort of thing. I wonder, are they, again, to generalize perhaps slightly, are they editorial in character, are they journalistic in character? Are they about storytelling, or are they lessons about the hard world of the business of independent publishing? Or I imagine it's probably a bit of everything. Have you been surprised about how much of a business hat you've had to wear for how much of the time? Is that balance okay? Is it what you foresaw?
The balance has definitely not... It doesn't feel that okay right now, if I'm really honest about it. And I do think you have to be honest about that when you're running independent magazines. You know, there is a lot of romanticism around it and a lot of hard work that goes into it, which, you know, I guess is why in part people love them. I think that I have to become more focused with future issues in terms of funding and making it a little bit more straightforward. That doesn't mean that they come out more frequently. It just means that I'm able to kind of balance doing the magazine with other areas of my work life. And I think, you know, I often tell people, they're like, oh wow, you work on this predominantly by yourself. And I was like, yes. They're like, you are insane. But it's interesting because, as you mentioned, you know, there are times where it sort of has me on my knees, and then there are other times where I'm so excited about it and I feel like I have something to say and to share with people, and it needs to come out. It's like a vehicle for that, I think. I have a few different countries that I'm exploring at the moment. I think some places that I'm really interested in is Greece. I think Greece, you know, it's not only a beautiful country, you know, steeped in a lot of wine history and culture. Obviously, commercially has had many problems too, but there's a kind of, you know, third generation of winemakers who are coming through, and they're totally redefining what we would perceive Greek wine to be. So that those types of, you know, countries are really interesting to me. And, you know, not to dismiss places like England. We had our best ever vintage last year. The English wine scene is growing all the time, and I'm quite intrigued to see what happens kind of post-Brexit.
Well, I think British winemakers, amongst probably British everybody's, are waiting to see what the post-Brexit landscape will look like. That's probably a conversation for another day. Amy, so great to speak with you. If this has piqued the interest of our listeners, how should they find out more and support Above Sea Level?
So I do distribute myself madly. So it is available internationally. In London, you can pick it up in places like Mad Culture, but you can also order it directly from my website as well.
Amy, it's an absolute delight to chat with you, and I do hope, wherever you alight next, that you'll come back and tell us about it.
I would love to. Thanks so much for having me, Tom.
Finally, on today's edition of The Stack, we're getting an update from another old friend, Dog Magazine. If you're unfortunate enough to be amongst the uninitiated, Dog is, in its own words, a modern lifestyle magazine exploring the presence and influence of dogs and their owners in society. Each issue centres on a specific breed, as selected by Dog founder Julian Victoria and the team. Well, for a discussion about the latest issue and to give us a general update on what's been getting tails wagging, I was joined a little earlier by two members of the Dog editorial team, Emily Rogers and Hannah Fitzsimons.
We just use dogs to start a conversation about lots of other things. So it's not necessarily just for dog owners or people who are dog crazy. Anybody who really loves those biannual magazines and, you know, exploring bookshops will hopefully love the magazine.
And what about in terms of once the vision starts to take shape and how, I guess, especially we're up to what, issue 5 now, how closely to your ambitions in that curatorial process almost, then when stuff starts to come in, shoots, features, all this kind of thing, are you at the point now where the need for some of the shorthand? You know, you've got people who understand your shorthand almost in terms of some of your contributors. Do they just, they know what you mean without you having to almost say it? Is that kind of happening more and more?
Yeah, I think so. We have people that we work with more or less every issue, don't we? Like Laura Feasey, who's one of our writers. Oscar Mitchell, who's one of the illustrators who we've worked with now for a few issues. So that's great, but then it's also about keeping a balance between finding new people who have, you know, who maybe don't know who we are, who can bring something really fresh. But yeah, now that we're on issue 5, I think that does really help because people have more of an idea of what we're doing and what we want, I suppose.
And what about, I mean, in terms of how Dog Tells Story, it obviously has a sort of, I think what's nice is a definitely recognisable look and feel. And yet there's always surprises issue to issue in terms of how the storytelling is happening, the kind of illustration, the balance of illustration to full blue photography to writing and all the rest of it. Are you fairly prescriptive in terms of how you want that balance to be, or do you let that unfold a little bit? Do you sometimes surprise yourself in a story that you envisaged happening one way is very different, and actually it kind of always feels like that was the right way? How does that process work?
We have sections that we always intend to have in every magazine and like revisit every issue. That's kind of in our plan, but then especially with this issue, things just get pushed out at the last minute. We've always done a map, for example, but then we took the map out because we had a really great interview come in at the last minute, which was the Simon Stevens one. It's good to have like a good idea of, okay, this is what we want, but then you have to be really open to, okay, let's lose this because this is great, and not be scared to change it up each issue.
And that's kind of, I guess, nice about being relatively small. There's a sort of fleetness of foot about how you can do that, that maybe some bigger publishers, they're sort of slightly more hamstrung by, well, it's been there since the get-go. Is there a sort of a perfect fighting weight almost in terms of the balance of being small, able to make decisions quickly, but having the resources to tell stories how you want to tell them?
Yeah, I think because there aren't so many of us on the team, it's quite easy to talk over those things and decide them as a unit.
I guess it's a measure, I suppose, of like, that's a bit of a tradition. There's some of the traditional editorial virtues really there. Different skill sets, taking the time to do things properly. And again, I suppose it's something on this programme we always come back to, which is, are people getting the chance to learn from doing, but having, you know, good editors working with them, getting the red pen out. We often talk about how the digital domain doesn't maybe afford aspiring journalists or illustrators the chance to sort of cut their teeth in that way. Is that something that you're mindful of? Is that important to you? Do you agree with that premise, I guess, first of all?
I think I do agree with it, yeah. The main focus is the magazine for us, and we like to do the traditional thing of sort of getting in the articles, getting them decide whether they want to be illustrated or get a photographer in. And we do very much prioritise sort of the printed matter, really.
I think that's really interesting because now, when you look at what traditional job titles like editor, you're not actually editing, you're probably managing a team and dealing with like getting in freelancers or having to sort out all sorts of managerial things. So actually being an editor and doing the editing is great. We all get involved in different areas outside of, I suppose, like what our roles traditionally are, like, you know, helping to arrange shoots and, you know, all sorts of things. But that's why I love doing this, because it is basically doing the editing, doing the interviews, doing the writing, as opposed to if it was maybe for like a really large corporation with the title editor, it might not actually be doing that at all.
And that was Hannah and Emily from Dog Magazine joining us on The Stack. And that's all we have time for on this week's programme. The show is produced by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, edited by Cassie Galpin and Kenya Scarlett. Any comments or queries are welcome. Drop a line to Fernando. You'll find him on fp@monocle.com. Don't forget to join us at the same time next week. That's The Stack. I'm Tom Edwards. Until next time, goodbye.